Well, it's knowing that your door is always open and your path is free to walk that makes me tend to leave my sleeping bag rolled up and stashed behind your couch. And it's knowing I'm not shackled by forgotten words and bonds and the ink stains that have dried upon some line that keeps you in the back roads by the rivers of my memory and keeps you ever gentle on my mind. It's not clinging to the rocks and ivy climbing on their columns now that binds me, or something that somebody said because they thought we fit together walking. It's just knowing that the world will not be cursing and forgiving as I walk along some railroad track and find that you're moving on the back roads by the rivers of my memory, ever smiling, ever gentle on my mind. Though the wheat fields and the clotheslines and the junkyards and the highways come between us and some other woman's crying to her mother cause she turned and I was gone, I still might run in silence, tears of joy might stain my face, and the summer sun might burn me till I'm blind. But not to where I cannot see you walking on back roads by the rivers flowing gentle on my mind. I dip my cup of soup back from a gurgling, crackling cauldron in some train yard. My beard a roughening coal pile and a dirty hat pulled low across my face. Through cupped hands round a tin can, I pretend to hold you to my breast and find that you're waving from the back roads by the rivers of my memory, ever smiling, ever gentle on my mind.
Hello and welcome to the Martian Drive-In Podcast number 55. My name is Terry Frost, and this time around we're going from 1955 to 1984. We're going to start with the first science fiction movie I ever saw in a cinema, and that is This Island Earth, starring Faith Demure and Rex Reason. And then we go to 1984 for a kind of a B-picture science fiction movie starring Dennis Quaid, and it is Dreamscape, which also stars Max von Sydow and Christopher Plummer, among other people. So it's a really interesting little piece of 1980s genre cinema. So sit back and we'll get the contact details out of the way and start the show. The Martian Drive-In Podcast appears every 2 weeks and is a podcast of science fiction, horror and fantasy movie appreciation. It doesn't matter what it is, it could be all the way from Georges Méliès through to Michael Bay, though I'm not likely to do Michael Bay. But feedback is important to me. So if you want to leave some feedback, you can leave it at cultguru, K-U-L-T-G-U-R-U, at gmail.com. You can leave it at the Martian Drive-In Podcast website, marsdrivein.blogspot.com. The other thing you can do is go over to the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook. So if you type in Paleo-Cinema Cafe into Facebook, you can go and leave some feedback there as well. Now, there are occasionally adult concepts in this podcast, so just keep that in mind as you listen, and sit back and enjoy the rest of the show.
Hi, how is everybody doing? It's fine here, except for one thing. There's an air show about 15 kilometres from this place, the Melbourne Air Show. So you're going to get sounds in the background of aeroplanes, probably intermittently, while I record, so it's going to sound a little bit like the Dam Busters around here, though hopefully we're not going to get any Barnes Wallace's bouncing bombs lobbing through the window of the man cave at me, but I will give you a warning if they do, because it's going to make a very loud noise. So how have you been? I believe the Northern Hemisphere has been suffering from the cold again, and the Southern Hemisphere hasn't. Yes, Leonard Nimoy died. I got the news this morning, which is kind of sad. I always liked him a lot more than I liked Shatner. Shatner always struck me as kind of a little bit of an attention seeker, where Nimoy just do what the things he enjoyed doing, just groove along, find some interesting projects. He did photography exhibitions of large women. He played music. He acted. He directed. He did a whole bunch of different things, and seemed to, once he came to terms with the fact that he had to a certain extent been typecast as Mr. Spock, really kind of come to terms with his life and lived it quite well. So, you know, he seemed to be a cool guy. And I believe he also donated a lot of money to get an Encore cinema back up and running in New York City that's now named after him. So I've always got a lot of time for people who earn a lot of money and then go and renovate cinemas. George R.R. Martin has done it in his hometown town of Albuquerque. And Tarantino did it as well at the New Beverly. And I kind of really think that that's one of the cool things you can do when you've got way too much money, is to get a flea pit, do it up, and show flicks that you like or flicks that you think people should see. If anybody ever wants to drop, say, I'd say 5 to 10 million on me, I'll do it in 2 or 3 different places around Australia, I promise. So there you go. If there are any mad and borderline demented billionaires lying around who listen to this podcast, go for it. I'd be very happy to share the love of cinema in a much broader and hard-topped kind of way. Even a drive-in cinema would be nice. Anyway, getting on to the podcast after that begging thing for imaginary billionaires. These movies are kind of interesting this time around. We've got 1955's This Island Earth, which is very cool. It's a universal horror film. It came out about a year before Forbidden Planet did, and kind of suffers by the comparison because the guy who wrote the original story upon which This Island Earth was based really couldn't compare with the guy who wrote the original story for Forbidden Planet, which was a guy called William Shakespeare. But anyway, yeah, I like the film, and it's got some very fond memories for me for a number of reasons I'll talk about in just a little while. Then we go to 1984 for a kind of B-picture science fiction slash fantasy movie, because it involves psychics, and that is Dreamscape, which has a really good cast. It's got Dennis Quaid, Kate Capshaw's in it, Eddie Albert, Christopher Plummer, Max von Sydow, and playing the villain of the piece, a character called Tommy Ray Glattman, we've got from The Warriors, David Patrick Kelly. So it's a great little film. The special effects let it down because it was 1984 and CGI wasn't really a thing. But I'll talk about that a little bit too. But first I'm going to talk about the stuff I have been watching. Now, for my ABC local radio NT gig, Liz picked the movie this time, and she's kind of embarrassed about picking this one. The movie she picked was Revenge of the Nerds from 1984, like this film that I'm going to talk about today. We didn't like it because basically if you rewatch the film, well, or don't rewatch the film, Liz said we watched it so nobody else had to. But if you want to rewatch the film, I'll give you 2 things of interest to figure out while you're watching it. Why everybody in the fucking movie wasn't arrested, all the characters, because the nerds are basically sex criminals by 21st century standards. They put hidden cameras in girls' dormitories. One of them pretends to be somebody else and then fucks somebody. It was really kind of icky from that point of view. And even though it does have some interesting things like an early role from John Goodman in it and a few other bits and pieces, that kind of put us off. It took us right out of the picture and something we didn't really get back into. So to combat that, next time around, we're going to see this kind of movie done well. And while we were actually talking, I thought up seeing this movie. You know, I'm kind of glad that I did. We're going to do Real Genius with Val Kilmer, which is a much better version of the trials and tribulations of being a nerd in university, starting out in university, which I think we'll like a lot more. But that's one of the films that I saw. So I don't recommend rewatching Revenge of the Nerds, even though you do have a kind of nostalgic fondness for it. I'm sure if you're of a certain age, you may well do. Nah, don't bother. Now, what else have I watched? Haven't watched a hell of a lot, really. What have I been doing? I think I've been resting mostly. I did see My Name is Modesty, the kind of small, low-budget Modesty Blaze movie from 2004 that I think Miramax at the time did so that they could keep the rights to the character of Modesty Blaze. It's not too bad. Directed by Scott Spiegel. Fairly low budget, filmed in Eastern Europe, of course, where all low budget movies of the early 21st century were filmed. But I kind of like it. It's, given the limitations that it has, it does a pretty good job of it. And Alexandra Staten, even though she's a little bit lean for the role, makes a reasonable modesty blaze in the film. So I rewatched that because it happened to be on cable. And so, and I couldn't be fucked changing the channel, really. But, yeah, it's not too bad at all. The other thing I've been doing is, and I made a purchase for myself, I got the first four seasons of the cartoon The Venture Brothers. And I've been going through season one and just enjoying that kind of meta stuff they've got there where they kind of mix and match and combine things like Johnny Quest and other retro kind of kids shows into a very kind of transgressive cartoon series, as well as chucking in a whole bunch of urban legends and cryptozoology and references to old movies and old TV shows and all sorts of things. Everything goes into the melting pot with the Venture Brothers, and it comes out really interestingly as well. Yeah, they've got Brock Sampson, the kind of bodyguard with the blonde mullet who throws Bowie knives at chupacabras and all that kind of stuff. So I've been grooving on that, and I'm about half the way through the first season. They're not long seasons, but as I said, I haven't been doing too much lately. And I really did enjoy it, so I had a bit of fun with that. On a slightly more serious note, I was watching Q&A, the Australian political TV program, on Monday night, and I was tweeting a little bit. Part of it was about domestic abuse. And I put in a few tweets to it, which get scrolled down the bottom of the screen, as some people who are on my Facebook may know. And my friend Liz at ABC Local Radio Darwin asked me whether I would come onto the radio, and this hasn't happened yet, but it's going to happen in about a week and a half to 2 weeks' time, if I would come on the radio and talk about my childhood experience of domestic abuse. I said yes. I think that you can hide this stuff, and that then sends a message to people that they're the only ones who go through monstrous experiences at a formative age. Or you can talk about it and talk about how you saw it through and the things you did to see it through. So I'm going to be doing that. I don't expect it to be an easy thing. Really, it does take you back to places where you've walked away from. But I think if it helps anybody out, and that's up in the air, I really don't know whether it will or not. But if it does help anybody out, it's a chance I'm going to take to kind of go back to those places and talk about them with a little bit of the distance of time helping. Because I do have post-traumatic stress disorder, it may well bounce back at me a little bit, but I've got techniques and I've got support to manage that. And I have talked to family members about the things I'm going to be talking about, and they're fine with me doing it the way I choose to do it because, as my sister said to me, it is my story. So I'm going to be doing that. That takes us out of the movie thing a little bit, but that's something I'm going to be doing. And I think it's a worthwhile thing to do. But anyway, let's move on with movies. First off, let's have a look at This Island Earth, which actually ties in with my family. I'll play a fan trailer that I found for it. And then I'll talk about when and where I first saw the movie.
The two of you are beginning a strange journey. A journey that no Earth people have ever undertaken before. Universal International presents the most startling, the most imaginative and suspenseful science fiction drama ever brought to the screen. You'll marvel at the superior intelligence that unleashes its deadly ray.
Dave!
Can kidnap an airplane in flight, prisoners hurtling through endless space, speeding toward the unearthly furies of a planet gone mad. See sights never before dreamed by man. The battle between guided meteors and deadly rays.
They're gonna hit us! They're gonna hit us!
A planet doomed to destruction, while captive Earth people fight for their lives.
It is indeed typical that you Earth people refuse to believe in the superiority of any world but your own.
I first saw this movie when it was re-released in the early 1960s at the Crescent Cinema in Fairfield, New South Wales, way back when the world was young and I was too. Here's what I remember, and memory is unreliable of its nature. We were staying with my grandparents who lived at Hammondville, not too far away. My mother, my brother, and I. My sister hadn't been born yet. Either of my sisters hadn't been born yet. We were staying there because there were problems with my father. I won't go into what they were, but there were problems with my father. And I was in a somewhat distressed state because of that. So my uncles, Roy and John, Roy looked a little bit like Mickey Rooney, but a lot taller. And John was an enormous figure of a man. He's the person I got my height from. All the rest of my family are short bastards. But I got to be 6 foot tall because of the same gene line that enabled my uncle John to be tall. So they took me to see this Island Earth, Roy and John, at the cinema. Now, I remember that it was a pretty shabby little cinema. It was much smaller than other cinemas I've been in. We went and got popcorn, and we went up into the balcony of the movie, and we watched this Island Earth. The only bit I found scary was the tubes that people are put in to acclimatize to the atmosphere of Metaluna, the bit where people kind of turn transparent and you can see their muscles and their skeletons and all that kind of thing. That scared me at the time. But the rest of it I loved, and I had a great time, and it took me totally out of the problems that I was experiencing with other realms of my life. And it probably started a pattern for me of escaping from some very difficult situations by going to the movies. I think that I wouldn't be podcasting now if it wasn't for things like that visit that my generous uncles gave me to see this Island Earth. Now, the other thing I remember about it, which is one of the cool things of the world, and something that I've mentioned before on podcasts, is that in the popcorn, down near the bottom, there was a little cowboy on a horse, a little plastic cowboy on a horse in there. Now, they wouldn't do it now because it's a choking hazard, and people would sue the cinemas and all that kind of shit. But at the time, it was a really cool thing. Just like these days, you do not get toys in breakfast cereals. Now, I think that's a totally outrageous thing. And it's absurd that I get outraged by that kind of thing. But I kind of like that. I like those little serendipitous discoveries. Finding toys inside things that are supposed to be food is always a cool thing. And I think it's something that children miss now unless they get Kinder Surprises. And Kinder Surprise toys are a little bit arsey, really, because you've got to put the bloody things together. You know, you've got to sit there for 10 minutes with stubby little children's fingers and put together the toy. It sucks. The toy should be more or less assembled when you get it. But that's just another rant for another time. But that's the thing I remember about this film, first seeing it. And so you can blame my now dead uncles, Roy and John, for starting me on the path of enjoying science fiction. And to be honest with you, I thank them for it. They were two role models for me up until my mother lost custody of my brother and I to my father. They were role models on, you know, how to be a man in a sense. And even though they weren't perfect people, Roy was a ladies' man, which was always a bit of fun. And John, there's a story about John. Here's what happened. I was sitting on a chair just outside John's bedroom. Now, this house was built just after World War One by returned soldiers. The whole suburb was built by returned soldiers helping each other get a home. And so the walls were basically covered in masonite boards. So I was sitting there, and my Uncle John was pissed off with something. And I was sitting in a chair just the other side of the wall, and an enormous fist came through two layers of masonite and ended up situated not too far from my head, because John was pissed off with something and had punched the wall. Now, he was incredibly apologetic, and he really didn't know I was there, and he didn't mean to punch the wall, but he was an enormously strong guy, and you try punching your fist through two layers of masonite board, it's a non-trivial task. It really does take some effort to do that. But that's who my uncle was. But anyway, I'm getting very nostalgic this time around. This movie is bringing up a whole bunch of shit from my childhood. Not bad shit, not the nightmarish shit that I'm going to talk about on the radio, but stuff that I find interesting. And yes, even though people can say it was a horrible thing that a fist appeared through a wall next to my head when I was a child, but to be honest with you, that's probably about number 936 on dodgy things that happened to me when I was a child. So it doesn't really rate on my radar personally, and it had no effect on me, apart from the fact that I only ever sit with my back to brick walls these days. But anyway, this Island Earth, Science fiction movies, and the thing to remember about science fiction movies in the 1950s were the audiences for them were vastly different than the audiences we have for science fiction movies made now. In the 1950s, they were for kids and teenagers and my uncles, basically. They went with a whole world of cinema viewing where you went once a week. You dressed up to go to the cinema as well. It was for kids' matinees on a Saturday afternoon and drive-in movies. It was a part of a world of popcorn, hot dogs, and double features with a cartoon and preview trailers and maybe a newsreel if you were lucky. It's totally different than what we do now, sitting in nondescript cinemas in enormous multiplexes, watching a whole bunch of ads for high schools. I mean, I don't know what you guys get in the ads that around your area when you go to the cinema, but we get a lot of high schools, insurance companies, and that's pretty much it, advertising in cinemas. And none of that stuff is for me. I don't have anybody I know going to high school soon. And if I was, I wouldn't be paying for it, so I don't give a fuck what kind of education they have. But cinemas these days are like that. And what else do they have in cinemas? Well, your radio stations I never listened to advertise in cinemas as well. But in those days, it was different. They had slides to show you any advertising for companies, and they were always local companies with little hand-drawn slides telling you to go and get a meal here and you'll get a dollar off it, or go to this place and they'll give you a good deal on a second-hand car. There was that kind of stuff. It was a totally more primitive but much more interesting way of having cinemas. And this Island Earth was a part of that. Now, this island, but what I'm trying to get to as far as the movies are concerned is that these would definitely be pictures, because nobody was going to invest any money in an A-picture science fiction movie. All of the biggest movies of all time were things like Gone with the Wind and Casablanca and all, well, not even Casablanca, but Gone with the Wind and all of those other things, which were kind of historical dramas, and there were some comedies in there as well, but science fiction wasn't really a big rater. It didn't make a lot of money for studios, so they weren't willing to invest money in it. And even if they did, there wasn't that whole generation of people who grew up watching movies like This Island Earth and Forbidden Planet who would then go on to have a passion for the genre and start the whole thing, which started before George Lucas, but included George Lucas and those guys. There was no Star Trek yet. The science fiction on television was very much like the early scenes in This Island Earth. Scientists in a lab testing out new things and going, hey, look at this. This is strange. Let's experiment with this. So there's a lot of that kind of science fiction on television and things like science fiction theater. But really the kind of space opera-ish elements that this movie has wasn't really a common thing at the time. And traveling to a planet in another solar system wasn't something that people had seen a hell of a lot in science fiction movies. Yeah, people went to Mars, people went to Venus, people went to Jupiter and all sorts of other places, but they didn't really go outside the solar system. And This Island Earth was the last movie, last big science fiction movie made before the game changer that was Forbidden Planet. Now, once Forbidden Planet came out, people didn't really invest a hell of a lot of money for a long time in science fiction films, but it was that kind of benchmark movie that showed them later on that, yes, money could be made on these films, and you could make an intelligent and nuanced, far-future science fiction movie that people would go and see. And Forbidden Planet, with its large budgets and the MGM studios fully backing it, really did form that benchmark. Now, this one was made by Universal, who were known for making horror movies and had been since way back early 1930s, maybe even into the 1920s, I'm not entirely sure. But they had a track history of doing monsters, and of course that's the reason why we have the iconic Metaluna mutant in This Island Earth, there, because of the necessity of a universal genre film having a monster in it. In fact, I'm looking up off at the shelves along the wall of the man cave, and one of the pop vinyl figures that I've got up there is a little pop vinyl figure of the Metaluna mutant from This Island Earth, which goes to show you that it is an iconic monster. It's ugly. It's got a head like a shaved scrotum. It's got those clawed hands. It shambles along. By the way, the reason why the Metaluna mutant in This Island Earth wears trousers is they couldn't get the costume for the legs and the bottom parts of the thing to work right. So they ended up getting a pair of pants and then just painting the feet kind of on it. But anyway, back to the actors. Let's talk about the actors for a little bit. They were all kind of contract players in the studios. There weren't any stars in this movie. Rex Reason had done westerns and other films of that kind. He and his brother Rhodes Reason, who was 2 years younger, but people thought they were twins, had both got contracts with studios and had careers that went into the 1960s. He later did a lot of voiceover work because he's got a deep and mellifluous baritone kind of voice. But he was just one of those kind of B actors that could turn their hands to film noir if necessary, or a western, or in this case, playing a gung-ho scientist in a science fiction movie. Now, Faith Demure is an interesting person as well. Here's what I know about her that makes her interesting. She started acting when she was about 14 or 15, and a couple of years after that, she had a car accident. And then after the car accident, she came to the attention of Howard Hughes. Howard Hughes groomed her. He got her voice lessons to get rid of the lisp and got her diction lessons to get rid of the southern accent. And he also had a relationship with her for about 8 years. Now, this started in her teenage years. The only problem was that I don't think she was a particularly gifted thespian. And she has a very serious demeanor about her. She's not one of those people who has any lightness to their acting. And it's possibly because, who knows, having a relationship with for a number of years with Howard Hughes would probably fuck up anyone. But she really does have a kind of serious demeanor about her, which doesn't quite play well in this kind of movie to a certain extent. Yes, she was an attractive woman. And she did say later on that she didn't wear any underwear when she was wearing the jumpsuit on the spaceship. So she didn't have any knickers on. And of course that is not an unattractive thing, but getting back to her, she is kind of that kind of B starlet kind of person where maybe if we were casting that female scientist role now, we'd get somebody with a bit of attitude to them. We'd get somebody who could plausibly play a scientist. And to be honest with you, neither Faith Demure or Rex Reason really come across very well as scientists. Rex Reason's buddy in the lab, who helps him build that iconic instrument of science fiction, zapping shit and television viewing, the Interocitor, had a much more interesting career even than Rex Reason did. That guy, Robert Nichols, spent the 50s as one of those contract players you get around to play sidekicks and things like that in a number of films for a studio. And then in the 1960s, he went to Broadway and became a very well-regarded Broadway actor, not in major roles and not in star roles, but he could sing, he could dance a bit. He was good in character parts and did that right up until around 2000. He had a very fruitful career as a Broadway actor. Now, let's talk about Jeff Morrow. Jeff Morrow playing Exeter with that suspicious bump on his head. Jeff Morrow always, in this film, even though he was a reasonable actor, he was also a commercial artist before he turned to acting. But Jeff Morrow in this movie always looks like one of the Thunderbird puppets because with that kind of bulging head and that neotenous look about him because of the bulging head and because of the way the makeup works, he does look like one of those marionettes in Thunderbirds. And that kind of takes me out of the film as well. He is playing it very stiff in this movie, and I think that it's maybe not a really great reading for playing a highly intelligent alien who travels to a much more primitive planet to get a whole bunch of 1950s American scientists and European scientists, to be fair to him, to help him basically keep the energy going to defend his planet from invading aliens with a force field by basically charging his ionosphere, the ionosphere of his planet with the high levels of radiation, which doesn't strike me as a good way of doing it. But, it's just that little bit stiff where maybe a more experienced actor would have done it a little more and a little more nuanced. But I always want people to act better than they have to in a genre film. I always think that people should bring their A game to it. Now, Jeff Morrow was a reasonable actor. I mean, he'd done Shakespeare and Rep. He served in the U.S. Army in World War II. He'd done Macbeth and a Catherine Cornell production of Romeo and Juliet. So, you know, he wasn't inexperienced as an actor, but this one doesn't bring his A-game. And contrary to that, of course, Dreamscape, which I'm going to talk about in a moment, has a lot more of that kind of stuff and has some actors doing some really cool stuff, even though it's not necessarily required of them to when they're making a genre film. And I love that. I love when actors go out of their way to really have a bit of fun and do that. But I'm not sure whether the studio system of the 1950s and Universal, the quick production times and the way the studios worked really let people have their head to that extent. They were almost like factory workers who went in and did a job and then left again and didn't necessarily get to show what they could actually do. But having said that, this movie is good in a lot of ways. The special effects, even though there are some problems with double exposure kind of special effects that don't necessarily work, and there are a few times when strings are visible and stuff like that. I like it for a number of the special effects in the film. First off, it's got eye-popping Technicolor. It's got that old-school Technicolor where they brought in Technicolor consultants, and it's more saturated than reality. And it's got that kind of richness of hue about it, which I like in science fiction movies. Yeah, there are good black and white science fiction movies. There's no question of it. But I do like nice eye-popping color ones as well. Not with the thing they do now where they shift the whole color palette on the whole movie because somebody said they should. But this one's got a more or less natural color palette, except in one scene on the spaceship, which may be a problem with the Technicolor processing where everyone's face looks purple for some reason. But yeah, I mean, it starts out well. Cal Meacham, who's borrowed a jet fighter to travel across the country, lands at his lab and finds out from his assistant that they've got some weird parts for a scientific experiment on radiation that they're doing. And they're replacing something the size of a suitcase with something the size of a bead. And the part tests really well as far as capacitance is concerned. And they look at getting some more of these things and end up with a large parts catalogue with fantastically advanced technology in it. And then they use those parts to build an interocitor. Exeter contacts them via the interocitor, then blasts apart the parts catalogue and the interocitor itself, because that's the best way to go and meet people, is to get them to build an elaborate machine. Incredibly complex, using futuristic technology and then just blowing it up after you leave them what's essentially a phone message. There's a lot of bits of this movie that don't make a lot of sense from that point of view. They make a lot of sense from the fact that they have flash bang and great big death rays shooting out of a triangular TV set kind of come stereo console. But, I mean, the other part that really doesn't make sense in this movie, and I'll jump ahead to that, is here they are, they kidnap the two scientists, take them to Metaluna so that they can convert lead into uranium and therefore allow the people of Metaluna to keep the shield up so that the invading aliens that we never see apart from their little tiny jet fighter type rocket ships cannot destroy the planet. But here's the weird thing for me. They rush these people there to do it, and too bad it's too late. The whole planet is being bombarded. It's like London on a bad night in 1941, but with much cooler architecture. And basically they get them there. The head guy says, no, take them away and brainwash them. They see a mutant. The mutant crawls onto the spaceship when Exeter suddenly has a change of heart and decides to take them back to Earth. They escape the planet blows up. So basically, there's no point to these people being taken to Metaluna in the first place. It's just there so that we can see the alien planet and see all the groovy special effects that the movie has backstacked into the last third of its runtime. But having said that, they are cool special effects, and the Metaluna mutant is very much a standard kind of, it's a very simplistic kind of monster. They said they bred it from insects. And it's got a slightly insectile look about it, but it doesn't have anywhere near the punch and the power of other Universal movie monsters. Frankenstein, Dracula, the Wolfman, the Creature from the Black Lagoon. It doesn't have anything like that. It's basically a lumbering thing. You might as well just have got Tor Johnson to do the job. But yeah, having said that, it's a nice piece of costume work. And yeah, I mean, the movie, if we remade it now, it could be made into a much better movie. I wouldn't be totally against a remake of This Island Earth. I think it could really be an interesting film. And as long as they kind of did things in a way that makes sense. There are plot holes in this that are fairly large. But having said that, Faith Demure and Rex Reason, yeah, B kind of actors in a B picture. But the special effects guys really take the cake for this one. The special effects were probably among the best that Universal did during this period. The eye-popping Technicolor really makes it work. They've got the usual Universal orchestral scores, some of which were done by people like Henry Mancini, amongst others, with those great big kind of blaring trumpet, da-da, kind of things to them. And we also get the other person who appears in the movie and is of interest, of course, is Russell Johnson, who later went on to play the professor in Gilligan's Island for way too long and unfortunately stereotyped himself because of the popularity of that show. But again, he was a jobbing actor. He started out in New York at one of the actors' workshops that sprung up there after the war. He'd been in World War II, as indeed had a lot of other actors of his time. And he did have some chops as an actor, but unfortunately because of, you know, sometimes it's luck, sometimes it's you get a role, you think this is going to be good, and then you end up stereotyped by it. But I don't think he got the breaks that he really needed. I think he was one of those actors that could do the job and probably could have shown us a lot more had he been given the opportunity to. And when you talk about old movies, that one of the things that comes up again and again is all of these people who you know could do really fine work on the screen, and for whatever reason, you know, whether it's fate, luck, or just because privately they were assholes, they were never given the opportunity to do that. I'm not saying that Russell Johnson was an asshole in any way, but I'll talk a little bit more about that kind of thing when I talk about Dreamscape. But, I mean, this one is one of those iconic classic films that if you saw it as a kid, you'd love it, even though it has all those flaws that I've mentioned in it. Kind of the way people are, I suppose, apologists for Star Wars these days, even though it's a piece of shit. But anyway, I'm going to leave it there for This Island Earth. I wanted to put it into the podcast because of that great memory I have of it and the fact that my uncles generously took me to see it and then kind of took me out of a bad place into a much wider world full of spaceships and monsters and interocitors and tiny computer parts that blow up spectacularly and television sets that can blast holes in lead sheeting and all sorts of other things like that. They took me to a different world. And if that's the case with this movie, then it's definitely done its job. It's there to show you things you haven't seen before and to let your imagination know that it's okay to go out and play sometimes. So I'm going to take a break now, and when I get back, I'm going to talk about a movie I saw as an adult, 1984's Dreamscape, starring Dennis Quaid, Kate Capshaw, Christopher Plummer, and Max von Sydow.
In a world in the year 2017,
in a time of tradition,
in a city where anything can happen, in a war that isn't his, every day in New York City,
on the Miami Police Force,
in the deep south,
from the sewers of Gotham, from the rooftops of Gotham, above Gotham,
within this skyscraper high above the city,
in a town driven by competition,
in a world that's powered by violence,
it's Christmas Eve in L.A.,
on New Year's Eve of the last decade of the 20th century,
Detectives Mike Lowry and Marcus Burnett,
Special Agent John Krueger,
Harry Tasker,
and New York cop John McLean.
They're not just partners. They were three cops who had nothing in common.
They are America's first line of defense.
But no matter how much you love them,
all that stands between a city and a disaster is a man,
a reluctant soldier,
an ex-con,
the perfect enemy.
They found him near a plane crash.
What if you couldn't remember?
The most deadly submarine ever built.
Secrets have a way of coming back to haunt you.
When ghosts start arriving by the boatload,
it was the perfect crime.
They thought they had it all figured out.
But there was one thing they didn't plan on.
Now,
They're about to collide.
One bullet at a time.
They can't change course.
But he doesn't have a choice.
His loyalty is to a child.
Fighting for everything he holds dear.
He's going to have to save her.
The only thing more dangerous than what he knows is the end of a man's journey.
He's back.
For good, for justice, for freedom, for family, for keeps.
The passion is real.
They don't follow the rules. They make them.
This summer, this fall,
this Thanksgiving,
but this Christmas,
this holiday season,
Academy Award winner Kevin Spacey,
Antonio Banderas,
Tom Hanks,
Kim Basinger,
Mel Gibson,
Brad Pitt,
Bruce Willis,
Sean Connery,
Robin Williams,
Denzel Washington,
Joe Pesci,
Samuel L. Jackson,
Ed Harris,
Ed Harris,
Ed Harris,
Ed Harris,
Ed Harris,
and Ed Harris.
The Long
Hunt.
For Legends of the
English Terminator Cousin,
Part 3.
Cruise control.
Like a can of peas, please.
That was just a little Don LaFontaine compilation to keep things going. By the way, I did know that This Island Earth was on in the movie Mystery Science Theater 3000, the movie. But I think they picked the wrong movie to make fun of in that one, because I don't think that This Island Earth really earned that kind of approach to things. I think it's too good a movie for Mystery Science Theater to take the piss out of. But having said that, they've done it already, so what can you do? But let's move on to 1984, a very interesting year in genre, because Revenge of the Nerds came out, and I told you how much I don't like that and for the what reasons. But this is just before, maybe a decade before CGI became viable. So all of the effects in a movie like Dreamscape are physical effects or else process shots of some kind. But having said that, I think they work well. There's even some stop motion in this one, which is a bit clunky, but it does have its own charm. So, and there are a couple of things they do that are quite clever to recognize dream states. But anyway, I'm getting ahead of myself here. 1984, Joseph Rubin directed this movie Dreamscape, based on a script by David Lowery. And it stars Dennis Quaid, Max von Sydow, Christopher Plummer, Eddie Albert, Kate Capshaw, David Patrick Kelly, and George Wendt in a role that doesn't really have to be there except to get him shot. The story's fairly simple, and I'll see if I can find a decent précis of it. A government-funded project looks into using psychics to enter people's dreams with some mechanical help. Well, some electronic help, anyway. When a subject dies in his sleep from a heart attack, Alex Gardner becomes suspicious that another of the psychics is killing people in their dreams somehow and is causing them to die in real life. He must find a way to stop the abuse of power to enter dreams. That's a shit one. And but you get the idea. Basically, Dennis Quaid plays Alex Gardner, a very gifted psychic who gets drawn back into a research program run by Dr. Paul Novotny, played by Max von Sydow, because they've made progress and they actually need him now. Now, the mysterious Bob Blair, played by Christopher Plummer, is very high up in the instrumentality of the American government and wants to basically weaponize this ability. And helping him in that is Tommy Ray Glattman, another gifted psychic played by David Patrick Kelly a couple of years after he really clinked those Coke bottles together in The Warriors and proved that he could have a very long and illustrious career playing nasty little shits. And he even turns up recently in a small role in the Keanu Reeves movie John Wick. I think he's quite good in it too. He plays a cleaner, but not the kind who dusts. But he was in a couple of episodes of Louie as well. I'm just looking up his IMDb now. Gossip Girl, Bored to Death TV series. Let's see what else he did. Flags of Our Fathers with Clint Eastwood. Yeah, so he's basically one of those actors who's very gifted, of course. You know, he couldn't do the things he's done and not be a gifted actor. But I believe he's done a hell of a lot of stage work and has preferred that. But, in this one, he is quite good as Tommy Ray Glattman. So you've got to have that Ray as a middle name. Any character in any movie or any TV show ever whose middle name is Ray, has to be some kind of a nasty bastard. It's just one of those rules. Probably that came up after the death of Martin Luther King, I suppose. But anyway, getting back to the movie, basically, this one's kind of fantasy because it's not really science fiction, even though it has the trappings of science fiction. Because psychics ain't real, it's a fantasy. It's like movies that have fast and light travel or time travel are basically fantasies as well. They're not really science fiction because these things aren't scientifically possible. Though time travel, maybe. Give us some time. Maybe they will. But having said that, I think the movie's good. Dennis Quaid starred in this movie, just having come off a really nice breakout role in The Right Stuff, playing Gordon Cooper, the astronaut. And he really did come to people's attention then. Many years later, anybody ever wondered why Dennis Quaid's career never went to where it should have gone, because, you know, he's a charming actor, he could play serious roles. If you see him in Far From Heaven in 2004, very good actor. Problem is, he liked to jam cocaine up his nose at one stage of his life, and he's admitted this, and he's since put himself out of that particular black hole. But the reason his career didn't go where it went to was he did have that addiction there, and it was known in the industry, and so the roles that he might have got, he didn't get. But having said that, in this one, he's quite good, and of course, if you see him in The Right Stuff, he's really great as Gordon Cooper, playing a real-life character who was part of the Mercury astronaut program. But in this one, he's charming and a bit of a larrikin, if you know what that word means, if you don't look it up. I kind of looked up how old he was when he made this movie. And, he was 30 when he made this film. He was 29 when he did The Right Stuff. So he was one of those guys who'd been around acting for a while. He'd done some kind of college comedies and those kind of things before this opportunity came up. And, of course, The Right Stuff came up. So he was 30, but he looks a lot younger. He's playing about a character maybe, I don't know, eight years younger than he is. We first see him at a racetrack where he's picking winners psychically, which probably means he's some kind of a precognitive, though that's never used for anything in the movie. It's kind of like the psychic abilities in this film are used a bit like a hand-wavy, bibbidi-bobbidi-boo kind of magical thing rather than anything that's quantified and codified at all. But, and he gets chased by a whole bunch of the sort of people you see hanging around race courses who want to use him to win money on the horses because he picks winners and then supplements his lifestyle by doing that. He's up until the age of 19, he was a part of that research project run by Paul Novotny, played by Max von Sydow. Very well. I like Max von Sydow in this movie. He brings an incredible gravitas and plausibility to anything he does. He even brought gravitas and plausibility to playing the villain in Strange Brew, that Canadian beer-drinking idiot comedy from the 1980s. So, doesn't matter what Max von Sydow does in a movie, he brings a really interesting persona to it. And I don't think he's ever really cashed a check. He really has a sincerity when he does roles that is an admirable thing. Of course, everybody remembers him from stuff like The Seventh Seal with Ingmar Bergman. And I liked him particularly in a 1960 spy movie I've talked about on Paleo Cinema Podcast, The Quiller Memorandum with George Segal and Alec Guinness. He is quite menacing and nasty and very effective in that film. But and then you get Christopher Plummer, Canadian actor, played a bald-headed Klingon in a Star Trek movie, but really he's one of those actors who's has great chops as an actor. He was actually up for an Oscar in the 2000s against Max von Sydow, even though they played together in this movie. Both of them were up for acting Oscars. And Plummer won a few years ago, and Max von Sydow didn't. But the movie, in essence, is basically an attempt to weaponize psychic powers and to be able to enter people's dream states and become a part of the dream and to influence the dream. In that sense, it's got a touch of the Freddy Krueger's about it. Nightmare on Elm Street came out roughly the same time, maybe a little bit earlier. And this movie kind of suffered in comparison to that in some people's minds, but I think they're very different kinds of films in a lot of ways because the focus isn't on the villain, the Freddy Krueger type character or the Tommy Ray Glattman type character. It's on the people who fight him. And while the movie is set up in such a way that there's not really any doubt that Tommy Ray Glattman and Bob Blair are going to lose, and of course the character played by Dennis Quaid, Alex Gardner, is going to win and get the girl, Jane DeVries, played by Kate Capshaw. She's a scientist working alongside Paul Novotny on the research thing. There's a mutual attraction, and because he's psychic, Alex knows this. And there is movies in 1984 really did transgress against women, and there is a scene where Alex walks in on Jane while she's napping in her office and slips into her dream state and turns it into a softcore porn women's fantasy kind of scene. And they have a brief conversation about whether it's right or wrong to seduce someone in a dream when you can get into their dreams. And they kind of, you know, the Jane character rationalizes that very quickly in order for the movie not to get bedded down in sexual politics. But it does bring up that question of, if you can slip into someone's dreams, it is wrong, but is it illegal to seduce them in a dream? And it does raise these issues, but then quickly dismisses them, which is a little bit of a shame in a way, because it's an interesting line of inquiry. I mean, it's, again, that kind of misogyny thing. It could be used in incredibly horrible ways, were it a real thing and were it to be used by somebody like Tommy Ray Glattman, who seems much more interested in Alex Gardner than he does in Jane DeVries. He actually goes into Alex's room while he's in the shower when he comes out with a towel around him, and Tommy Ray Glattman is playing his saxophone, which has got to be a little bit of symbolism there, playing another man's saxophone while he steps naked out of a shower. There is something there, and you've got that kind of undercurrent to the movie as well. Now, George Wendt turns up as Charlie Prince, who's a novelist who's investigating the strange goings-on around the place. He's there just basically so the menace can be ramped up by him being killed by the bad guys led by Bob Blair. And Christopher Plummer's definitely got that banality of evil thing down. He wears suits very well. He's high up in the government. He does have the ear of the president, played by Eddie Albert. President's never given a name. He's just the president. Now, the president is having nightmares about nuclear annihilation, and these nightmares are leading him to wanting to make a treaty with the Russians in order to bring the world back from that brink of nuclear war, whereas Bob Blair thinks otherwise. Now, Eddie Albert, I didn't think much of Eddie Albert as an actor for a very long time, but I've seen him in enough different things now that he really was good at his job. And the other thing I found out about him that surprised me, given the fact that where I'd first seen him was playing the comedy foil to Zsa Zsa Gabor and a bunch of yokels in Greenacres. And when I say Greenacres, I mean the TV series and not the suburb of Sydney, is that when he was in World War II, he was a genuine war hero, which is really interesting. He was in US Army Intelligence, awarded a Bronze Star with a Combat V for his actions in the invasion of Tarawa in the Pacific, when, excuse me, as a pilot of a US Coast Guard landing craft, he rescued 47 Marines who were stranded offshore while under heavy machine gun fire. Now, this is a guy who, he started acting before the war, but after the war, as an actor, he really had nothing to prove. He proved himself in the most difficult of circumstances during the war in November 1943. So, you know, a gutsy guy, but he never took that macho on the screen very much. He really didn't use that as anything else, the way that, say, an actor like Lee Marvin managed to show that stoicism and strength in the roles he did. He was very much a lighter actor than he ever was during his military career, which makes it kind of interesting that somebody would go from doing those incredibly brave and meritorious things to being a kind of lighter style of actor. But, you know, people are all different, and that's the interesting thing about it, that you hear, there are people about whom you have certain preconceptions when you see them doing a certain thing. And then as you dive deeper into it, which we can now do thanks to the miracle we call the internet, you find out that they are much more than just that persona that is so familiar to you from some of their work. But Eddie Abbott plays the president quite well, I think. He's more kind of a Ronald Reagan-aged president. He's unlike Reagan, he does have white hair. And the nightmare scenes he has are kind of very stylized in a way. He has his wife running away from New York City. You can see the Twin Towers in the background, which makes it extra poignant. And then suddenly behind her is a nuclear blast, and she gets overwhelmed by the nuclear blast. It's done with the kind of special effects they had available in the 1980s. But even as a kind of slightly abstracted nightmare, it works really well. And there's another scene where Alex gets into the dream states of a guy who works on high-rise construction. And they both get caught on an I-beam that's suspended over off a building. And they're both kind of scrambling to stay on this I-beam as it swings around. And the interesting thing that Lowry and the director Ruben do is while they're having that dream sequence, there are fast clouds flying across the sky. So they've kind of superimposed a speeded up view of the clouds so it doesn't look realistic. They filmed it with no particular camera trickery, but it's those fast clouds ripping across the sky that give you the sense that they're in a dream. And it's a very effective and kind of low rent way of conveying the fact that these guys are in a dream and they're not in a real world situation. I kind of like that. I like the way they did that. Now, the climax of the film, where obviously Tommy Ray Glattman and Alex go head to head in the dreams of the president. Now, this is one of those movies that may well have influenced Inception. But that one, it's a little bit hurried in a way and limited by the special effects they have. The president and Alex get chased through a dreamscape of post-apocalyptic nastiness with red glowing-eyed dogs in it and Tommy Ray showing off his kung fu chops using nunchucks with Morningstar heads on the ends of them and that kind of thing. But it does seem that the budget didn't allow them to play more in the dream worlds, which is a little bit of a shame because it's one of the more interesting parts of the movies. And the movie then, of course, gets filled out with Alex being chased by the bad guys through a race course while he's on a motorbike and they're in cars and they've got the cars ripping down the racetrack, shooting at him. Another chase thing where he's in a phone box. Remember phone boxes? And a car rams at the phone box, that kind of stuff. There are those kind of TV-level special effects things that are there partly to say, yes, he's being menaced by the bad guys, but also to fill out the running time where the more special effects heavy sequences weren't able to be done because they're more expensive. And there's a snake man in one of the nightmares. There's a comic scene, and this movie does, the more I think about it, seem like it might have been trimmed a little bit. There's a comic scene with Larry Gelman playing an insecure man who's having problems with his love life with his wife. And they go into his dreams and find out why. And it's a little bit of a comic thing about this man's insecurity, about his own masculinity. And it kind of plays tonally very different from the rest of the film. And I'm not sure that's entirely necessary for the film as well. We know that this dream stuff works. We know it's used for therapeutic purposes because Alex uses it therapeutically with a kid. We don't need that kind of comic lightness of basically an aging guy worried about whether he can get his dick up. It's a tonal shift that doesn't really work well to support the premise of the film, which goes from romantic comedy to chase theme to espionage thriller to science fiction to fantasy quite smoothly in some ways, but really doesn't. This movie, again, this is another one that could well do with a remake because we've now got the technology to have the eye candy that people require from this thing where people can drop into dreams. But though I suppose it will suffer. If someone did a remake of Dreamscape, it is suffering in comparison to things like Inception, Christopher Nolan's Inception, because that pretty much has a similar premise. Now, one of the sources that I got for this movie said that the science fiction writer Roger Zelazny had something to do with the genesis of this film in some ways. Zelazny, we know, of course, from the Amber Chronicles and a number of other things he did. Now, according, this is a Wikipedia thing, and there's no solid attribution for it. So, here's what it says in Wikipedia. According to the author Roger Zelazny, the film developed from an initial outline that he wrote in 1981, based in part upon his novella He Who Shapes and the novel The Dream Master. He was not involved with the project after 20th Century Fox bought his outline. Because he didn't write the film treatment or the script, his name does not appear in the credits. Assertions that he removed his name from the credits are unfounded. So it's one of those things where because he wrote just an initial treatment, I didn't even do the treatment, just because he wrote an outline for them, he doesn't get a Guernsey, but basically his idea is the one that ultimately became the genesis of this particular movie, which is a bit of a shame, because Roger Zelazny could have really, there are a lot of his projects that would lend themselves really well to being used by film and television a lot more. I mean, you could always do the Amber Chronicles as a kind of Game of Thronesy, but with much more magic TV series. And I'm sure somebody's thought of that. Sorry, I'm typing here and I didn't mean to. The only thing of his that people really know that's been adapted was Damnation Alley, which was made into a very bad movie. There was a couple of episodes of the 1980s Twilight Zone series that were based on his stuff, and a video game. But I think there's a ton of Zelazny's work which would lend itself well to adaptation in TV or movies if the rights were purchased, and if the right kind of scripting came along for it. I think somebody would have to have a lot of faith in the material to do that. I'm not sure how much of it would have dated by now, though I think the Chronicles of Amber would adapt themselves very well to a television series in particular. But yeah, so I was a little, I was going to do this movie anyway. I was a little surprised that there's actually a legitimate science fiction writer link. I remember seeing this movie on VHS originally, and I know it did really well on VHS here in Australia. People were just so hungry for genre stuff that the Australian companies that had the rights to movies were just pumping this stuff out by the ton. There are so many genre films from the 70s, 80s, and even into the 90s that came out on tape and were really popular and were going out as a rental a lot, that this was definitely one of them. I remember so many times seeing that kind of pseudo Raiders of the Lost Ark cover that they put on the VHS box, because Kate Capshaw was in the second Indiana Jones film. She later married Steven Spielberg and have had 5 kids together. But I've found that the less I speak about Steven Spielberg on podcasts and on social media, the less arguments I get into, because I've got a slightly lower opinion of most of his output than a lot of other people do. And I do get into some quite heated discussions. I never get heated about them, but other people get heated about them because Spielberg and Lucas are little tin gods to a lot of people, whereas I think that Lucas is overrated and Spielberg's oeuvre is blatantly emotionally manipulative. I don't mind it at all if a movie seduces me, but I hate it when they stick their cold hands into my trouser pockets and try to jerk me off. And that's what I feel like when I see some things of Spielberg's, particularly stuff like E.T. I hate the emotionally manipulative stuff with those immense stringy John Williams music things. They just put me totally off. By the way, this movie, Dreamscape, has a nice Maurice Jarre soundtrack. Now, the producers originally wanted him to do an orchestral soundtrack for the movie, but he decided to do an electronic soundtrack with lots of synths and things like that in it, because he said it would work better for the type of movie this is. And to be honest with you, even though it's a slightly dated style of soundtrack, it is quite right for this kind of movie, and I think it works well. So there are some people of great skill working at this one. You've got Von Sydow, you've got Plummer, you've got Maurice Jarre, you've got special effects guys who did a really fantastic job on this one. I'm just going back and back-clicking, and you'll hear the clicks here. I apologize for hearing the clicks every time I look at something while I'm doing this. But the special effects guys on this did a great job with physical effects and, of course, with the production effects on this thing. Let me have a look here. I'm just finding it out there. Yep, Craig Reardon's makeup effects. Let's see who else. Greg Cannon worked on this one as well. So all of those guys who were known experts and later become even more expert in physical effects worked on this film. There is some cool stuff in there. It does have a very 1980s look in some ways. Greg Cannon won an Academy Award as well for his effects work. And yeah, this movie, of course, it's like This Island Earth. The effects are dated, but they have their own charm because they're of their time. And with This Island Earth, of course, there are matte lines around certain things and all of that kind of stuff. But you accept that because they didn't have a way of doing it better at the time. When I talked about the birds a few episodes ago, I said that Disney had the only really good way of doing, of avoiding matte lines, and that process was very expensive, and they didn't lend it out very much, but they did lend it to Hitchcock in 63. That's one of the problems with these films, is there were kind of proprietary ways of avoiding some of the problems that they have, but they weren't shared equally. And that's the difference with, I think, CGI. There are so many people trying to put out software that does certain things as far as special effects in television and movies and other kinds of video, that people have access at not large amounts of money to some very sophisticated effects software if they really want to go with it. The reason why things like the Sci-Fi Channel movies and the Asylum films have such cheesy special effects is they're not willing to pay the money to get it done well. It can be done well, not too expensively, but it also takes time. You've got to kind of crunch those ones and zeros to make the effects work. So things like the Asylum and Sci-Fi Channel go with the cheesy special effects, which have become part of their style, because they're not willing to, say, let something render for ages and ages on a render farm in order for it to look photorealistic. They just go with what's fast, cheap, and available. But anyway, that's about it for that film. I like it a lot. I think I like it in some ways. I think it's got fewer plot holes than This Island Earth does. But I like it because it takes me back to 1980s. Saturday night, you know, you'll go and get some fish and chips. You'll rent a couple of movies from the video shop. You don't have to sit on your ass and torrent them. You have to go down to a video shop. You've got to see what's in, because it was a scarcity economy working then, where if the most popular movie at the moment wasn't in, you had to go and order it, and then they'd tell you when it was in, and then you have to go back to the video shop and all that kind of shit, which you don't do now. But I enjoyed that. It's always good negotiating with whoever you went in with about which movie to see and which videos to rent and whether we could afford to rent 10 or whether we could afford to rent 1. There was all those kind of negotiation skill things that are just not part of life now. Kind of like the standing up in the cinema when I was a kid. People used to stand up in the cinema because the cinemas would play God Save the Queen and have this little video clip of Elizabeth II on a horse and all that kind of stuff. Don't do that anymore. It's not part of life anymore. Though for me, what I used to do is I used to go down to a Chinese supermarket and buy the snacks, because the snacks were cheaper and they were weirder. So you'd end up chewing on something made out of dried octopus while you're watching these movies, and then having a drink of some kind of anonymous Asian soft drink that you don't know what kind of fruit it was supposed to have in it, but you just drank it anyway because it tasted okay and it would cost you like 50 cents for 4. But, yeah, I mean, I've got a great nostalgia for going out to get movies rather than having movies come to me. And I think that, yeah, if nothing else, you get a little more cardio doing that than you do sitting on your ass with a torrent or with iTunes. But anyway, I'm going to leave it there for the podcast. I'm going to do feedback next time around, because I want feedback to build up a little bit before I do it, and I'm not getting that much. I do have something nice from Morris. Our good friend Morris from Love That Album podcast and See Here podcast. His podcasting empire is diversifying enormously. Morris and I had a meet-up last week too. We met up in a cafe and got to the cafe and sat down, and it was his turn to pay for the coffees, and we got the coffees. And then a thunderstorm hit and everything looked really weird outside. It was getting very apocalyptic with lightning strikes and the city buildings and all that kind of stuff. So we had a great time and caught up and talked about movies and talked about our lives and stuff like that. So it's always nice to do that with another podcaster, because they understand the peculiar kind of addiction that is podcasting. But anyway, on that note, look after yourselves. I'm going to leave you, of course, with the credits. Please, if you've got a couple of bucks to spare, support the podcast via the Patreon campaign. And with the Patreon campaign, here's an extra. In April, I will be giving away a box full of movies and movie-related stuff to one of the Patreon subscribers. I don't care whether they're next door or on the other side of the planet. I'm making sure I've got light things. I'm going to send them a box full of stuff. So anyway, look after yourselves. I'll be back soon. Support the Patreon campaign if you're inclined that way. And I'll be back next week with another Paleo, in 2 weeks' time with another MDIP. And take care. Again, thanks to all of the lovely people who support the podcast through the Patreon campaign. And as usual, in the manner of movie credits, here are their names and their jobs in the mythical Paleo Cinema Martian Drive-In movie. Thank you to Alyssa the Location Scout, Tansy the Foley Artist, Miss Jane the Wardrobe Mistress, Christopher the Gaffer, Chris the Camera Operator, Julia the Casting Director, Elaine, the Scientific Advisor, Matt, the Rattlesnake Wrangler, Armin, the Key Grip, Jan, the Dialect Coach, Morris, the Musical Director, Gary, the Prop Master, Tom, the Focus Puller, Sarah, the Special Effects Technician, Ian, the Caterer, Grant, the Technicolor Consultant, and our newest supporter, Claire, the Script Doctor. So thank you very much to all of those people, and if you'd like to join them on the credits, go to patreon.com/paleocinema. I'd also like to thank Sally, who is the assistant to Mr. Frost and his muse, and also to Mr. Debussy for playing his music, The Gollywog's Cakewalk. I'll see you all again soon.